This is Clinical Conversations. Dr. Sandro Galea has written a book about health. He's dean of the Boston University School of Public Health, and he trained as an emergency physician. His book, which is titled Well, doesn't really deal much with clinical medicine. Instead, it's about those things that lead to the clinical encounter. And as he shows, the factors leading up to disease often exist in the remote past, generations earlier sometimes. He populates his book with a range of people from Blind Willie Johnson, one of whose haunting blues songs is on the Voyager space probe, to Rudolf Virchow, 19th century pathologist and reformist politician, to Charles Dickens, to Spock the alien, and yes, Donald Trump. They illustrate various aspects of what I take to be Galea's main point, that health is a public good worthy of public investment. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, Dr. Galea.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
I like the image that you have in the book of a clinician who heroically dives into a river to save drowning people. And sooner or later, the clinician must stop to ask, who's throwing all these people into the water? And so the subtitle of your book sets the stage nicely. And the subtitle is What We Need to Talk About When We Talk About Health. Are we indeed talking about the wrong things when we talk about health in the U.S.?
I think we are. And I want to be careful to say that I'm not making an or argument. I'm making an and argument. I do not want to be misunderstood in any way that I am saying anything against the importance of clinical medicine or of clinical care. As I often say when I'm doing my public lectures, when I have a heart attack, I want the best possible doctor to look after me. So this is not an argument against clinical medicine. Yep. It is a more inclusive argument that says that if we care about health, we need to understand that health is not created at the moment of the clinical encounter, that the clinical encounter, by and large, is a curative encounter where the patient, the person is already a patient, where the person has some reason to see a doctor. So I'm interested in how do we create a world where people are as healthy as possible. So to go to your river analogy, the clinician's job is to jump in the river and pull patient after patient from the river. And I think it is a noble profession, one in which I trained. But I think we all would rather live in a world where there are fewer people thrown in the river to begin with. And what's that mean? How do we get there? Well, it means that we pay attention to housing. We pay attention to people having a livable wage. It means we pay attention to parks that allow us to have recreation, to social connections, so we're not socially isolated. We create a world where there is compassion, and we create a world, fundamentally, as you said, where we recognize health is a public good that is worthy of our collective investment. And that world is a world, I would argue, that is quite far from the world we live in right now.
So it's an and argument.
It's definitely an and argument.
But there will be a time when to invest more in the public good, we're going to have to do some or thinking as well, I guess. But maybe we'll get to that later. The chapter headings are a nice kind of guide to the problems that you believe that Americans have to discuss when they discuss health. For instance, the roles of money, power, place where people live, and actually the role of the past, as I mentioned in the introduction. You start with that. You mentioned a fictional character, a young woman, whose life has been framed by a series of things, including where she was raised, etc. Can you talk about those general topics?
Yeah, so I suppose the topics go from the concrete to the abstract. I do think that when we talk about health, we need to talk about power, money, and politics. We need to understand that our political decisions about what food to subsidize influences what foods ultimately make their way in front of us, and what foods we're likely to eat, and whether or not we have a national epidemic of obesity as we have now. Mm-hmm. That decisions made at the intersection of politics and power determine whether or not we treat firearms as a special consumer good that allow us to have the number of firearm deaths that we have today. That's power, politics, money. Then there are issues about where we live, about the places where we are, and our circumstances throughout our life, that we need to understand that a middle-aged woman presenting to her physician because she has 30 pounds overweight and is in need of a knee replacement was not always thus, that she gained that extra weight because of circumstances in her childhood which did not allow her to have access to healthy, nutrient-rich foods due to economic circumstances of her parents and of where she grew up. And that means understanding health as a product of where we grew up and how we grew up. And then there are chapters around us having to have the humility to recognize that we do not, that there are different ways of thinking about health, that we have a very deterministic way of seeing health right now, where we say, well, heart disease is the largest contributor to mortality, therefore we should have a National Institute of Heart Disease. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, but we also can recognize that smoking is the largest contributor to heart disease. Maybe we should have a National Institute of Smoking and Health. Mm-hmm. And similarly, maybe we can recognize that low education is the principal reason why people smoke, and maybe we should have a National Institute of Low Education and Health. And that lens simply says that the production of health is much more complex than we have given it credit for. And to understand health properly, we need to understand all these aspects.
Now, you make a distinction between health and health care. So, and health care being the system under which sick people achieve cure or treatment. And health is that environment of things that maybe will keep them from having to get a clinical encounter.
Well, it is. And the limited access to clinicians when one needs them is also one of the drivers of poor health, obviously, because at the end of the day, as I mentioned, we will all need clinical care at some point, and we want to have access to it. And of course, the entire national argument about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is about making sure that people do have access to clinical care when they need it. At the same time, we often over-focus on the role of access to care at the expense of these other forces. In many respects, the national conversation has been so convulsed with attention to Obamacare, which, just to be clear, has been a necessary and important addition to our national armamentarium to keep people healthy. But that has happened almost to the exclusion of all other conversations.
It's true that Obamacare was a kind of an exercise in political power as well, as was Medicare and Medicaid. There had to be a kind of a grand bargain among the drug companies, the organized medicine, and the insurance companies in order to get Obamacare moving down the ways.
Absolutely.
And so we're realizing some of the disadvantages of that grand bargain now. But as you said, we've expanded access to care. And I think what you also say is that we need to fashion another conversation about health, as opposed to how do we afford it?
That's correct. That's correct. And I like, Joe, your use of the sentence, we need to fashion another conversation. That's exactly right. I think we spend a lot of time correctly talking about how can we afford health? How can we afford, and what we mean is how can we afford health care? And that's an important conversation to have about healthcare costs in the country and access to healthcare. All of that is important, but we need to have an equally important, if not more important, conversation about what is it that generates health. And in fact, the when you look at most statistical estimates, medicine and healthcare generates maybe 10% of our health. The rest of our health, maybe another 20%, is our genetics. The other 70% is our health behaviors, is our environments. It's where we live, the people we interact with. And that other 70% is the percent that we are not paying attention to.
You say that we spend a lot of time in the current system chasing after treatments, some of which, when we achieve them, are enormously expensive, and not enough time on infrastructure. But the money for infrastructure, where might that come from now?
Let's take something that we say very frequently, which is that the U.S. spends more on health than any other country in the world. And that's inaccurate. It's we do not spend more money on health than any other country in the world. We spend more money on healthcare than any other country in the world. And the when you look at the sum of money we spend on healthcare and on these other forces that generate health, on housing, on social supports, on parks and recreation, we in fact spend substantially less than most other high-income countries. So at the end of the day, we need to recognize that A, in total, we're spending less than many other high-income countries, and B, the vast proportion of that is healthcare. So we need both a recalibration and more spending if we generate, if we value our health. And poll after poll after poll show that we value our health. It doesn't matter if you're blue American or red American or purple American. The one thing we all agree on is that we want our children to be healthy. So we agree on that, but we do not act accordingly.
I wanted to ask you, what was there something that prompted you to write this book? Did you have a kind of an insight that made you say, I've got to write a book about this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm often asked, how long did it take you to write the book? And my answer is about 20 years. Now, It didn't take 20 years to write the book, but it's sort of 20 years of ideas that have accumulated over time. And I think these are ideas which I developed in a life in academic health. And then when I became dean of a school about 5 years ago, I really sharpened my thinking about looking at data and saying, this is outrageous. Health is the only sector where we spend more than everybody else and we get less out of it than everybody, than other countries. We would not accept that for our smartphones. If I told you and your listeners that our smartphones cost us 40% more than the next closest competitor, but they work worse than all other smartphones that our other high-income countries have, would you accept that? We would not. If I told you our food costs 40% more, but it tastes worse than everybody else, would we accept it? No, but we accept that in our health. So this became a bit of a concern, and I've been trying to think about how do I present these points in such a way that it nudges forward our conversation. That's what the book tries to do.
And you say in the toward the end of the book that this is really a kind of a long preliminary book, preliminary to another book that you haven't written yet, or maybe you are in the process of outlining or something. But this is a kind of a conversational opener, isn't it? This book.
It is. It is. One way to look at it is that the book's aspiration is grand, and that it aims to nudge a conversation forward. But of course, no one book ever does that. But the hope is to have conversations like this, and then to have other people write other books, and other people push the conversation forward. I challenge listeners and readers to have this conversation with 20 of their friends and family members, and then to challenge those 20 to have other 20, and that's how conversations change.
One of the things that you use as a vehicle in the book is following the health of a woman named Sophia from her early life until her later life. And at the end of the book, you say, let's look at this woman who is poor and brought up under adverse circumstances. Let's look at her life if it were different. And then you present her in a kind of a very different light. She wasn't born into wealth still, but she was given the advantage of better places to live, better education, availability in the public schools, etc. Is that what you hope for your children and grandchildren?
I do, and I have yet to meet anybody who does not want their children to be healthier. I have yet to meet anybody who actually likes spending time going to their doctor. This is I think no doctor listening should take that as a personal offense. It's the analogy I use sometimes is, what about your car? Does anybody actually like taking their car in to the mechanic? And the answer is no. Everybody just wants their car to work. And similarly with doctors, people want to live their lives and be healthy. So, now let's be clear. Our cars will always need to go into mechanic, and we're always going to need doctors, and that's okay. So doctors should not feel threatened. But at the same time, we go to medical school driven by a motivation to keep people healthy. Doctors, every single doctor I've ever met, chose to go to medical school because they were interested in making people healthy. And I think many of us then realize that what we're doing is not necessarily the most productive way of doing that. So my challenge is to doctors to keep doing what you're doing, be the best possible doctor you can be, but also be part of the conversation that elevates what it takes to make people healthy.
And it seems it seems that you are really calling for more action, especially when you discuss things like compassion versus empathy. A chapter which struck me particularly. You said that empathy is the equivalent of saying, "Well, our thoughts and prayers go out to you after a Virginia Beach shooting," but compassion is trying to do something about that so that
That's
it doesn't
correct.
Happen again.
I said Martin Luther King on compassion.
As a good
quote, which I'm going to paraphrase because I don't remember it exactly, which is compassion is not flinging a coin at the beggar. It is asking why he's a beggar to begin with. Compassion is looking at the fundamental drivers of these forces. So empathy, I argue that empathy is what we traffic in most of the time, where we say, I feel your pain, and because you are I can imagine myself being like you, I want to help you. That is empathy. That's what drives charity. Mm-hmm. Compassion is a higher order. Compassion says, I don't need to feel, I don't need to be able to envision myself like you. I simply, as a fellow human being, recognize your dignity and your rights to be healthy. And I want to create a world that makes you healthy, whether I can feel myself in your shoes or not. So compassion is a higher order feeling. And it's a feeling that can drive us to create a world that generates health much more to my mind than is empathy or charity.
What have your colleagues said about your book?
The highest compliment I've received is people who say to me, well, everything you're saying in the book is obvious. And I enjoy that comment very much because that means that I'm saying things that are intuitive, that are just under the surface of our consciousness. Now, the trick is to take them from under the surface and to elevate them and make them part of our mainstream health conversation.
Uh-huh. What would you like... in addition to having everyone who's listening here read your book, what idea would you like them to take away from it, especially the clinicians? What can a clinician do you think, that you would like them to do?
I think the clinician needs to keep doing what she's doing day to day, which is restoring people to health, but also be a part of the national conversation that makes it clear that clinical medicine is just one part of the full set of forces that generate health. And investing in the public and private sector actors that understand that. At some level, clinicians are citizens, but they're also citizens who are seen by the rest of society as understanding health and being spokespersons for health more so than many other citizens. So clinicians saying that, no, housing policy is health policy, economic policy is health policy, parks recreation policy is health policy, violence is a public health problem, that goes a long way.
So that widens the clinician's lane. I remember that the...
Yes. I have written about this. I've written about the clinician's responsibility, and I would encourage clinicians to make this their lane.
Okay. Well, Dr. Galea, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed talking.
That was our 226th clinical conversation. The whole searchable collection is available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. Let us know how we can improve these chats. Email me at jelia@nejm.org. We come to you from NEJM Journal Watch. The executive producer is Kristen Kelly. I'm Joe Elia. Thanks for listening.